down.
I saw a hummingbird yesterday.
Oh, I had one buzz me and say, where the hell's my food?
You can get
April showers bring May flowers.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it because last year it was a couple months. It was in June before I saw
them. Yeah, it was like, where are they?
Yeah. Well, I would like to welcome again Perry Dean Young. Welcome, Perry.
Well, nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. You just, now you've got this narrative out and you've got all your books and everything that you've done. I just don't even know where to start. Where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with Earth Day and being thankful for the rain. You know, we hadn't had any rain in a while. I've looked after the grounds at the Women's Center, the Compass Center, for 23 years.
Wow.
And come on by and look at the iris are in full bloom now in Foxglove. About 2 months ago, I just despaired over the deer eating all my flowers. So I read somewhere to get herbs, to plant herbs, because the deer don't like herbs.
Oh,
they don't
eat herbs.
And so I got a ton of foxglove, but I planted all kinds of herbs. Well, of course, the deer haven't been back.
That's a great thing to know.
No. I have a lot of other things, pansies and other. They love pansies. They love begonias. I now have lots of pansies and begonias. And,
oh, that's fantastic.
And they haven't touched them. I have no idea. I think it's construction down below where I live. That's
maybe. See, that's
but it's
what's
nice
driving
not having
them to
them.
My yard.
I love deer, but I don't like them eating my flowers.
I know. My problem is groundhogs. I've got this monster groundhog in the neighborhood.
I guess the other thing is bathrooms. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Jesse Helms was a crackpot TV guy. His editorials would come on at midnight, for God's sake. They'd play Dixie
that
like
a hymn.
That was
a good time for him. Should have been like 3
oh,
in
yeah,
the morning.
Oh, yeah, 3 in the morning, yeah. And
they played Dixie while his editorial was...
like a hymn, slowly, slowly.
Right.
No, that was their sign-off thing.
Dixie
played like a hymn, slowly, not like a military march. And anywhere you would go, then, of course, the crackpot became a U.S. senator, you know? We elected him.
Right.
And anywhere you would go in the world, you would say, I'm from North Carolina. They would say, Jesse Helms. Well, now you say you're from North Carolina. They say, bathrooms.
Exactly.
What a joke, you know?
Oh, these idiots have made... It's just so disgraceful.
Yeah, they've just made such a... You know, Kathleen Parker, I don't know if you read her in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. She won a Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. I hope you read her column today.
No, I didn't.
Well, by chance, she was going on Meet the Press... with the governor, after the governor of North Carolina.
Okay. But they were in the makeup.
And they were sitting in the green room waiting to go on. She didn't go on with him, unfortunately. Neither did Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews is a very proud UNC grad. He would have ripped him apart, you know.
Wow.
And he loves North Carolina. But she says she's sitting there with the governor of North Carolina, and they've both just been through makeup and hair and all that thing. And what do they talk about? Their makeup. And she said it was all she could do to make some crack at the governor about the bathrooms. You know?
I'm not sure that I could have bitten my tongue.
Oh, no. But what a joke they made. Apparently, the Prime Minister of England and the President of the United States both had statements today about what a joke it is. But the thing is, somebody once said, about Jesse Helms, they said even his mistakes are calculated.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Don't kid yourself about this bathroom bill. They knew exactly what they were doing.
Right.
But I hope it's backfired on them. I mean, the one thing they understand is money, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's it, and that's where it's been hitting North Carolina.
Yeah.
You know, when you start hitting the big boys, then they have to start listening, and that's probably the only reason that it'll ever change, you know. In my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, they've dug in their heels now.
Well, tell us about your writing career. You've just been a writer for how many years? A lot of years.
Oh, Lord. Don't go into it.
we won't talk about the numbers.
Well, started out writing in high school. You know, I got 20 cents a line for stuff I contributed to the Asheville paper. You know?
No kidding.
And I was editor of the high school newspaper, too. And then I came to Carolina, and... in 1959, if you're looking for numbers, I was a freshman. And the journalism school, one of the courses I took, required you to publish 3 articles. Well, I walked into the Daily Tar Heel office, And I'm fresh off the farm, and the farm had gone bankrupt. My father had just died. It was just a real, you know, just getting the hell out of the mountains for a while was a great relief. But I was horribly insecure. And I go into the Daily Tar Heel office, and there are all these tough guys just strutting around, talking real loud. And I ran out of the building.
Did you really?
But I could be very bold with a typewriter, so I wrote the travel editor of the New York Times. I was also working for the State Department of Archives and History over at the Bennett Place. I'm a closet historian.
Oh, okay.
And I wrote him, and he liked my letter, and so I sold my three articles to the New York Times for $75 each.
Oh my God.
That's incredible.
The professor, who a lot of people didn't like, because he was a tough New Yorker, and he said, you know, if you want to write for yourself, you keep a journal. If you want to write for somebody else, by God, you look at what they want. And that's exactly what I did. I read the New York Times travel section, and I figured out what they wanted. And over the years, I sold about 15, 20 articles to him. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Wow.
But shyness can pay off sometimes.
If you know how to use it.
If you know
it,
how
right?
to use it, yeah.
Yeah.
But the first book was about Vietnam. My two close friends were both captured in Cambodia in April 6, 1970. And...
Now, give people a little bit of background. You went to Vietnam as a war correspondent, correct?
Right. I was with UPI, United Press International, which really doesn't exist anymore. But
right.
at one time, there was the Associated Press and United Press, and,
right.
and both of them were worldwide organizations. And UPI, though, would just, they'd send young people into things. I covered the 1963 legislature for UPI.
Oh, my goodness.
I was 21 years old.
Yeah. Wow.
And talk about an experience. That was the height of the civil rights movement. And
mm-hmm.
I'll never forget one night. When this was a Democratic legislature, it wasn't a Republican legislature, but we had a wonderful governor at that time, it was Terry Sanford, and it was the first time they were in that new building, and they were just like, you know, rednecks from Podunk in a classical, in a mansion.
In a palace.
Right.
And running around all those gardens and stuff. But one night, the civil rights demonstrators completely encircled the building. And it just overwhelmed everything going inside. And they carried on as if nothing were happening. And they tried to do that the whole year, yeah. So we've dealt with this before. There's nothing new about any of this right-wing stuff. It's just we always had people, responsible people, bankers and business people who kept a lid on it, though, in the times past. And now... The
you can't
inmates
keep
are,
a lid on anything anymore.
The inmates are running the asylum
yeah,
now.
No
and,
kidding.
And what infuriates me is some of them, everybody thinks this is all redneck inspired. I mean, McCrory's from Ohio, and Phil Berger is from New Rochelle, New York.
Really?
And they have the nerve to talk about outside agitators. Yeah, that's why
really?
one of the Moral Monday things, we all wore signs saying,
right.
Outside agitator
yes.
from Woodfin, North Carolina, which is where I'm from. You know.
Right.
But I went to Vietnam. First of all, I was drafted. I was not drafted. I joined the Army Reserve, which, like George Bush, was a way to get out of the draft. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have an active reserve, which they have to serve. You know, they actually go into combat. In those days, you didn't.
Right.
The reserve was like a state National Guard or something, and it wasn't national. It wasn't active. It was a reserve.
Right.
And so I went through that, and when I got out, UPI hired me in New York, but on condition I'd be sent to Vietnam as soon as there was an opening, and of course there was within a few months. And meanwhile, I got to live in New York and had the time of my life, you know.
Oh, that's so cool.
But
what did you think about going to Vietnam when they asked you to go over there?
They didn't ask me. I asked them, yeah.
Oh, you wanted to go.
Oh, yeah. See, I was in the Army Reserve,
yeah.
And I told the guys I was with, I was in a unit out on Long Island, and those guys had just gotten back from Vietnam, and they couldn't imagine anybody wanting to go there. And somebody said, I'm probably the only guy who, in history who ever went AWOL in order to go to a war. But I told him, they said, we'll just mark you present. And I just took off and went to, and just totally disregarded my military obligation.
Wow. But you were doing so much more than you would have done with that military obligation.
I hope so. I don't know. Yeah. But I got to Saigon the night the Tet Offensive began and made some wonderful friends there. I mean, you learn things in war you learn nowhere else. And that's right. No excuse for it. But it's where, many hundred thousands of us came of age, and
right.
We learned things about ourselves and about humanity that we would never have learned before. And I continue to believe that we need something like the Israelis have, that everybody owes their country a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
whether it's as civilian duty or, the William James wrote an essay, we must find a civilian equivalent of war, the experience of war, but there's that whole
giving of yourself for others.
Yeah,
a common good.
Yeah, yeah. And the politics of the war, of course, is despicable, but all of that was back in Washington. On the ground, it was a war like any other war, mm-hmm. people killing each other,
Yeah.
That's what war's always about. And it's always been stupid. It's never made sense,
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, Hitler had to be stopped, we know that, but the thing when you're out there with the people fighting, it's just people killing each other. And you forge bonds there. And two of the bonds I forged were with Sean Flynn, Errol Flynn's son, who looked exactly like him, by the way.
Wow.
Errol had the grace to say, he looks like me, but better, And Sean had always lived in his father's shadow, but in Vietnam, he established his own identity. He was not Errol Flynn's son anymore. He was a very brave correspondent, a photographer. And the other was Dana Stone, who was just a terrific little guy from Vermont, who was just an amazing photographer and incredibly brave. And the two of them, shortly after the Americans invaded Cambodia, they decided to go across the lines on their motorcycles, by the way. And Flynn was wearing flip-flops and cut-off jeans and a T-shirt. And they drive their motorcycles deliberately into the communist lines,
Wow.
And a group of correspondents stood there and watched them do this, And of course, they never came back. They were probably tortured to death. We don't know exactly what happened.
Wow.
But anyhow, Dana Stone's wife was trying desperately to get publicity about the whole thing. I was writing for Harper's Magazine at the time, so I wrote an article for Harper's. And when that came out, I then got a contract to expand it into a book about them. And I went back to Vietnam and Cambodia, ostensibly looking for them.
How much later was it when you went back?
Well, they were captured in 70, and I went back in December of 72, I think it was. And of course, the war was in full swing. I mean, Cambodia, you couldn't move around Cambodia. I really wanted to go to Angkor Wat as a tourist because I'd never gotten there, but you couldn't get anywhere near there then.
So you ended up writing a book about him.
I wrote the book about it, but it started out as a way to convince the communists that they were not CIA people, that they were correspondents, that they really were legitimate correspondents. Mm-hmm. And
hold up the book. And this book, you can buy this book, right?
This photograph of them was taken 15 minutes before they were captured, before they set off,
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's kind of very dramatic because the two of them sat there teasing each other, macho teasing. Dana saying, I've got a wife back at the hotel, and saying it's really dangerous. And Flynn saying, of course it's dangerous. That's why it's a good story,
Wow.
Of course, they went down that road and they never came back.
Man.
Perry, we only have about a minute and a half, and you have some more material that you want to talk about that goes with the book.
Oh, you want me to read this?
You have some snippets from a CD recording.
In December, I did a CD with a German band that had been had done a recording of called Indochina, and they just wanted me to read some vignettes from my Vietnam experience.
Okay.
And I'll read just a couple of them.
Okay.
I don't know what to
have. Got about a minute left.
Yeah.
Okay. We stand waiting to get on a medevac chopper into the fighting across the river in the old Hue Citadel. Two medics come out of a doorway labeled Make Love, Not War, and start cooking a goose they've just liberated from a nearby house. Mm. We watch as a spotter plane gets shot down just a few hundred feet from us. A jeep roars up with the pilot's charred body, unzipping the bag so the body will cool. The sweet, acrid odor mingles with that of the goose as the medics sit down to eat.
Mm. Wow.
This is from my journal I kept. At Charlie Med now at Quezon, waiting for a helicopter to come through the fog and carry me out of here with the wounded. 31 on the last two choppers, 9 dead here now beside me in those black rubber body bags that make it all seem so clean. Tape recorder plays Donovan, singing about the sunshine coming through his window. Mm. A young medic sweeps the floor with a bloody broom, whistling the tune. In 2010, a group of war correspondents had a reunion where we dedicated a monument to the memory of all the correspondents who were killed in Cambodia and Vietnam. Mm-hmm. 35 years have now passed since the end of the war. We gather in Cambodia and Vietnam to pay tribute to those who did not survive. We sit among Buddhist monks on the spot where two American television crews were beaten to death. We stand where Flynn and Stone were last seen alive. We walk in horror among the human bones that still litter the killing fields. Someone asks the question that haunts us all. Why were we able to live on while so many others died? Frangiola says we were left to bear witness. I hope I'm doing a little bit of that today.
Wow. You always do.
You did
Perry,
a good job.
And your
of
website
it.
Is author Perry Dean with an E on the end, young.com.
Thanks to you.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on. It's so great to see you.
Yeah.
And we're out. Happy Earth Day.